temptation that occurred in between. On day 7, participants in the control condition remembered everything they had originally learned, even showing an enhancement of abstraction and retention of knowledge relative to initial levels of learning, just as we'd expect from good sleep. In contrast, those who had their sleep laced with alcohol on the first night after learning suffered what can conservatively be described as partial amnesia 7 days later, forgetting more than 50% of all that original knowledge. This fits well with evidence we discussed earlier, that of the brain's non-negotiable requirement for sleep the first night after learning for the purposes of memory processing. The real surprise came in the results of the third group of participants. Despite getting 2 full nights of natural sleep after initial learning, having their sleep doused with alcohol on the third night still resulted in almost the same degree of amnesia. 40% of the knowledge they had worked so hard to establish on day 1 was forgotten. The overnight work of REM sleep, which normally assimilates complex memory knowledge, had been interfered with by the alcohol. More surprising, perhaps, was the realization that the brain is not done processing that knowledge after the first night of sleep. Memories remain perilously vulnerable to any disruption of sleep, including that from alcohol, even up to 3 nights after learning, despite 2 full nights of natural sleep prior. Framed practically, let's say that you are a student cramming for an exam on Monday. Diligently, you study all of the previous Wednesday. Your friends beckon you to come out that night for drinks, but you know how important sleep is, so you decline. On Thursday, friends again ask you to grab a few drinks in the evening, but to be safe, you turn them down and sleep soundly a second night. Finally, Friday rolls around, now 3 nights after your learning session, and everyone is heading out for a party and drinks. Surely, after being so dedicated to slumber across the first 2 nights after learning, you can now cut loose, knowing those memories have been safely secured and fully processed within your memory banks. Sadly, not so. Even now, alcohol consumption will wash away much of that which you learned and can abstract by blocking your REM sleep. How long is it before those new memories are finally safe? We actually do not yet know, though we have studies underway that span many weeks. What we do know is that sleep has not finished tending to those newly planted memories by night 3. I elicit audible groans when I present these findings to my undergraduates in lectures. The politically incorrect advice I would, of course never, give is this. Go to the pub for a drink in the morning. That way, the alcohol will be out of your system before sleep. Glib advice aside, what is the recommendation when it comes to sleep and alcohol? It is hard not to sound puritanical, but the evidence is so strong regarding alcohol's harmful effects on sleep that to do otherwise would be doing you, and the science, a disservice. Many people enjoy a glass of wine with dinner, even an aperitif thereafter. But it takes your liver and kidneys many hours to degrade and excrete that alcohol, even if you are an individual with fast-acting enzymes for ethanol decomposition. Nightly alcohol will disrupt your sleep, and the annoying advice of abstinence is the best and most honest I can offer. Get the nighttime chills. Thermal environment, specifically the proximal temperature around your body and brain, is perhaps the most underappreciated factor determining the ease with which you will fall asleep tonight, and the quality of sleep you will obtain. Ambient room temperature, bedding, and night clothes dictate the thermal envelope that wraps around your body at night. It is ambient room temperature that has suffered a dramatic assault from modernity. This change sharply differentiates the sleeping practices of modern humans from those of pre-industrial cultures and from animals. To successfully initiate sleep, as described in Chapter 2, your core temperature needs to decrease by 2 to 3 degrees Fahrenheit, or about 1 degree Celsius. For this reason, you will always find it easier to fall asleep in a room that is too cold than too hot, since a room that is too cold is at least dragging your brain and body in the correct, downward, temperature direction for sleep. The decrease in core temperature is detected by a group of thermosensitive cells situated in the center of your brain within the hypothalamus. Those cells live right next door to the 24-hour clock of the suprachiasmatic nucleus in the brain, and for good reason. Once core temperature dips below a threshold in the evening, the thermosensitive cells quickly deliver a neighborly message to the suprachiasmatic nucleus. The memo adds to that of naturally fading light, informing the suprachiasmatic nucleus to initiate the evening surge in melatonin, and with it, the timed ordering of sleep. Your nocturnal melatonin levels are therefore controlled not only by the loss of daylight at dusk, but also the drop in temperature that coincides with the setting sun. Environmental light and temperature, therefore, synergistically, though independently, dictate nightly melatonin levels and sculpt the ideal timing of sleep. Your body is not passive in letting the cool of night lull it into sleep, but actively participates. One way you control your body temperature is using the surface of your skin. Most of the thermic work is performed by three parts of your body in particular: your hands, your feet, and your head. All three areas are rich in crisscrossing blood vessels, known as the anteriovenous anastomosis, that lie close to the skin's surface. Like stretching clothes over a drying line, this mass of vessels will allow blood to be spread across a large surface area of skin and come in close contact with the air that surrounds it. The hands, feet, and head are therefore remarkably efficient radiating devices that, just prior to sleep onset, jettison body heat in a massive thermal venting session so as to drop your core body temperature. Warm hands and feet help your body's core cool, inducing inviting sleep quickly and efficiently. It is no evolutionary coincidence that we humans have developed the pre-bed ritual of splashing water on one of the most vascular parts of our bodies, our face, using one of the other highly vascular surfaces, our hands. You may think the feeling of being facially clean helps you sleep better, but facial cleanliness makes no difference to your slumber. The act itself does have sleep-inviting powers, however, as that water, warm or cold, helps dissipate heat from the surface of the skin as it evaporates, thereby cooling the inner body core. The need to dump heat from our extremities is also the reason that you may occasionally stick your hands and feet out from underneath the bed covers at night, due to your core becoming too hot, usually without your knowing. Should you have children, you've probably seen the same phenomenon when you check in on them late at night, arms and legs dangling out of the bed in amusing and endearing ways, so different from the neatly positioned limbs you placed beneath the sheets upon first tucking them into bed. The limb rebellion aids in keeping the body core cool, allowing it to fall and stay asleep. The coupled dependency between sleep and body cooling is evolutionarily linked to the 24-hour ebb and flow of daily temperature. Homo sapiens, and thus modern sleep patterns, evolved in eastern equatorial regions of Africa. Despite experiencing only modest fluctuations in average temperature across a year, plus minus 3 degrees Celsius, or 5.4 degrees Fahrenheit, these areas have larger temperature differentials across a day and night in both the winter, plus minus 14 degrees Fahrenheit, or 8 degrees Celsius, and the summer, plus minus 12 degrees Fahrenheit, or 7 degrees Celsius. Pre-industrial cultures, such as the nomadic Jabra tribe in northern Kenya, and the hunter-gatherers of the Hadza and San tribes, have remained in thermic harmony with this day-night cycle. They sleep in porous huts with no cooling or heating systems, minimal bedding, and lie semi-naked. They sleep this way from birth to death. Such willing exposure to ambient temperature fluctuations is a major factor, alongside the lack of artificial evening light, determining their well-timed, healthy sleep quality. Without indoor temperature control, heavy bedding, or excess nighttime attire, they display a form of thermal liberalism that assists, rather than battles against, sleep's conditional needs. In stark contrast, industrialized cultures have severed their relationship with this natural rise and fall of environmental temperature through climate-controlled homes with central heat and air conditioning and the use of bed covers and pajamas, we have architected a minimally varying or even constant thermal tenor in our bedrooms. Bereft of the natural drop in evening temperature, our brains do not receive the cooling instruction within the hypothalamus that facilitates a naturally timed release of melatonin. Moreover, our skin has difficulty breathing out the heat it must in order to drop core temperature and make the transition to sleep, suffocated by the constant heat signal of controlled home temperatures. A bedroom temperature of around 65 degrees Fahrenheit, 18.3 degrees Celsius, is ideal for the sleep of most people, assuming standard bedding and clothing. This surprises many, as it sounds just a little too cold for comfort. Of course, that specific temperature will vary depending on the individual in question and their unique physiology, gender, and age. But like calorie recommendations, it's a good target for the average human being. Most of us set ambient house and/or bedroom temperatures higher than are optimal for good sleep, and this likely contributes to lower quantity and/or quality of sleep than you are otherwise capable of getting. Lower than 55 degrees Fahrenheit, 12.5 degrees Celsius, can be harmful rather than helpful to sleep, unless warm bedding or night clothes are used. However, most of us fall into the opposite category of setting a controlled bedroom temperature that is too high, 70 or 72 degrees. Sleep clinicians treating insomnia patients will often ask about room temperature and will advise patients to drop their current thermostat set point by 3 to 5 degrees from that which they currently use. Anyone disbelieving of the influence of temperature on sleep can explore some truly bizarre experiments on this topic, strewn throughout the research literature. Scientists have, for example, gently warmed the feet or the body of rats to encourage blood to rise to the surface of the skin and emit heat, thereby decreasing core body temperature. The rats drifted off to sleep far faster than was otherwise normal. In a more outlandish, human version of the experiment, scientists constructed a whole-body thermal sleeping suit, not dissimilar in appearance to a wetsuit. Water was involved, but fortunately those willing to risk their dignity by donning the outfit did not get wet. Lining the suit was an intricate network of thin tubes or veins. Crisscrossing the body like a detailed road map, these artificial veins traversed all major districts of the body: arms, hands, torso, legs, feet. And like the independent governance of local roads by separate states or counties of a nation, each body territory received its own separate water feed. In doing so, the scientists could exquisitely and selectively choose which parts of the body they would circulate water around, thereby controlling the temperature on the skin surface in individual body areas, all while the participant lay quietly in bed. Selectively warming the feet and hands by just a small amount, 1 degrees Fahrenheit, or about 0.5 degrees Celsius, caused a local swell of blood to these regions, thereby charming heat out of the body's core, where it had been trapped. The result of all this ingenuity: sleep took hold of the participants in a significantly shorter time, allowing them to fall asleep 20% faster than was usual, even though these were already young, healthy, fast-sleeping individuals. Not satisfied with their success, the scientists took on the challenge of improving sleep in two far more problematic groups: older adults who generally have a harder time falling asleep, and patients with clinical insomnia whose sleep was especially stubborn. Just like the young adults, the older adults fell asleep 18% faster than normal when receiving the same thermal assistance from the bodysuit. The improvement in the insomniacs was even more impressive: a 25% reduction in the time it took them to drift off into sleep. Better still, as the researchers continued to apply body temperature cooling throughout the night, the amount of time spent in stable sleep increased, while time awake decreased. Before the body cooling therapy, these groups had a 58% probability of waking up in the last half of the night and struggled to get back to sleep, a classic hallmark of sleep maintenance insomnia. This number tumbled to just a 4% likelihood when receiving thermal help from the bodysuit. Even the electrical quality of sleep, especially the deep, powerful brainwaves of NREM sleep, had been boosted by the thermal manipulation in all these individuals. Knowingly or not, you have probably used this proven temperature manipulation to help your own sleep. A luxury for many is to draw a hot bath in the evening and soak the body before bedtime. We feel it helps us fall asleep more quickly, which it can, but for the opposite reason most people imagine. You do not fall asleep faster because you are toasty and warm to the core. Instead, the hot bath invites blood to the surface of your skin, giving you that flushed appearance. When you get out of the bath, those dilated blood vessels on the surface quickly help radiate out inner heat, and your core body temperature plummets. Consequently, you fall asleep more quickly because your core is colder. Hot baths prior to bed can also induce 10 to 15% more deep NREM sleep in healthy adults. An alarming fact. Adding to the harm of evening light and constant temperature, the industrial era inflicted another damaging blow to our sleep: enforced awakening. With the dawn of the industrial age and the emergence of large factories came a challenge. How can you guarantee the en masse arrival of a large workforce all at the same time, such as at the start of a shift? The solution came in the form of the factory whistle, arguably the earliest and loudest version of an alarm clock. The whistle's skirl across the working village aimed to wrench large numbers of individuals from sleep at the same morning hour, day after day. A second whistle would often signal the beginning of the work shift itself. Later, this invasive messenger of wakefulness entered the bedroom in the form of the modern-day alarm clock, and the second whistle was replaced by the banality of time card punching. No other species demonstrates this unnatural act of prematurely and artificially terminating sleep, and for good reason. Compare the physiological state of the body after being rudely awakened by an alarm to that observed after naturally waking from sleep. Participants artificially wrenched from sleep will suffer a spike in blood pressure and a shock acceleration in heart rate caused by an explosive burst of activity from the fight-or-flight branch of the nervous system. Most of us are unaware of an even greater danger that lurks within the alarm clock: the snooze button. If alarming your heart, quite literally, were not bad enough, using the snooze feature means that you will repeatedly inflict that cardiovascular assault again and again within a short span of time. Step and repeat this at least 5 days a week, and you begin to understand the multiplicative abuse your heart and nervous system will suffer across a lifespan. Waking up at the same time of day, every day, no matter if it is the week or weekend, is a good recommendation for maintaining a stable sleep schedule if you are having difficulty with sleep. Indeed, it is one of the most consistent and effective ways of helping people with insomnia get better sleep. This unavoidably means the use of an alarm clock for many individuals. If you do use an alarm clock, do away with the snooze function and get in the habit of waking up only once to spare your heart the repeated shock. Parenthetically, a hobby of mine is to collect the most innovative, that is to say, ludicrous, alarm clock designs in some hope of cataloging the depraved ways we humans wrench our brains out of sleep. One such clock has a number of geometric blocks that sit in complementary shaped holes on a pad. When the alarm goes off in the morning, it not only erupts into a blurting shriek, but also explodes the blocks out across the bedroom floor. It will not shut off the alarm until you pick up and reposition all of the blocks in their respective holes. My favorite, however, is the shredder. You take a paper bill, let's say $20, and slide it into the front of the clock at night. When the alarm goes off in the morning, you have a short amount of time to wake up and turn the alarm off before it begins shredding your money. The brilliant behavioral economist, Dan Ariely, has suggested an even more fiendish system wherein your alarm clock is connected by Wi-Fi to your bank account. For every second you remain asleep, the alarm clock will send $10 to a political organization that you absolutely despise. That we have devised such creative and even painful ways of waking ourselves up in the morning says everything about how underslept our modern brains are. Squeezed by the vice grips of an electrified night and early morning start times, bereft of 24-hour thermal cycles, and with caffeine and alcohol surging through us in various quantities, many of us feel rightly exhausted and crave that which seems always elusive, a full, restful night of natural deep sleep. The internal and external environments in which we evolved are not those in which we lie down to rest in the 21st century. To morph an agricultural concept from the wonderful writer and poet Wendell Berry, modern society has taken one of nature's perfect solutions, sleep, and neatly divided it into two problems. 1. A lack thereof at night, resulting in 2. An inability to remain fully awake during the day. These problems have forced many individuals to go in search of prescription sleeping pills. Is this wise? In the next chapter, I will provide you with scientifically and medically informed answers. Chapter 14. Hurting and Helping Your Sleep. Pills versus Therapy. In the past month, almost 10 million people in America will have swallowed some kind of a sleeping aid. Most relevant and a key focus of this chapter is the use, abuse of prescription sleeping pills. Sleeping pills do not provide natural sleep, can damage health, and increase the risk of life-threatening diseases. We will explore the alternatives that exist for improving sleep and combating insipid insomnia. Should you take two of these before bed? No past or current sleeping medications on the legal or illegal market induce natural sleep. Don't get me wrong, no one would claim that you are awake after taking prescription sleeping pills. But to suggest that you are experiencing natural sleep would be an equally false assertion. The older sleep medications, termed sedative hypnotics, such as diazepam, were blunt instruments. They sedated you rather than assisting you into sleep. Understandably, many people mistake the former for the latter. Most of the newer sleeping pills on the market present a similar situation, though they are slightly less heavy in their sedating effects. Sleeping pills, old and new, target the same system in the brain that alcohol does, the receptors that stop your brain cells from firing, and are thus part of the same general class of drugs, sedatives. Sleeping pills effectively knock out the higher regions of your brain's cortex. If you compare natural, deep sleep brainwave activity to that induced by modern-day sleeping pills, such as Zolpidem, brand name Ambien, or Esopiclone, brand name Lunesta, the electrical signature, or quality, is deficient. The electrical type of sleep these drugs produce is lacking in the largest, deepest brainwaves. Adding to this state of affairs are a number of unwanted side effects, including next-day grogginess, daytime forgetfulness, performing actions at night of which you are not conscious, or at least have partial amnesia of in the morning, and slow reaction times during the day that can impact motor skills such as driving. True even of the newer, shorter-acting sleeping pills on the market, these systems instigate a vicious cycle. The waking grogginess can lead people to reach for more cups of tea or coffee, to rev themselves up with caffeine throughout the day and evening. That caffeine, in turn, makes it harder for the individual to fall asleep at night, worsening the insomnia. In response, people often take an extra half or whole sleeping pill at night to combat the caffeine, but this only amplifies the next day grogginess from the drug hangover. Even greater caffeine consumption then occurs, perpetuating the downward spiral. Another deeply unpleasant feature of sleeping pills is rebound insomnia. When individuals stop taking these medications, they frequently suffer far worse sleep, sometimes even worse than the poor sleep that led them to seek out sleeping pills to begin with. The cause of rebound insomnia is a type of dependency in which the brain alters its balance of receptors as a reaction to the increased drug dose, trying to become somewhat less sensitive as a way of countering the foreign chemical within the brain. This is also known as drug tolerance. But when the drug is stopped, there is a withdrawal process, part of which involves an unpleasant spike in insomnia severity. We should not be surprised by this. The majority of prescription sleeping pills are, after all, in a class of physically addictive drugs. Dependency scales with continued use, and withdrawal ensues in abstinence. Of course, when patients come off the drug for a night and have miserable sleep as a result of rebound insomnia, they often go right back to taking the drug the following night. Few people realize that this night of severe insomnia and the need to start retaking the drug is partially or wholly caused by the persistent use of sleeping pills to begin with. The irony is that many individuals experience only a slight increase in sleep from these medications, and the benefit is more subjective than objective. A recent team of leading medical doctors and researchers examined all published studies to date on newer forms of sedative sleeping pills that most people take. They considered 65 separate drug placebo studies, encompassing almost 4,500 individuals. Overall, participants subjectively felt they fell asleep faster and slept more soundly with fewer awakenings, relative to the placebo. But that's not what the actual sleep recordings showed. There was no difference in how soundly the individuals slept. Both the placebo and the sleeping pills reduced the time it took people to fall asleep, between 10 and 30 minutes, but the change was not statistically different between the two. In other words, there was no objective benefit of these sleeping pills beyond that which a placebo offered. Summarizing the findings, the committee stated that sleeping pills only produced slight improvements in subjective and polysomnographic sleep latency, that is, the time it takes to fall asleep. The committee concluded the report by stating that the effect of current sleeping medications was rather small and of questionable clinical importance. Even the newest sleeping pill for insomnia, called Suvorexant, brand name Belsomra, has proved minimally effective, as we discussed in Chapter 12. Future versions of such drugs may offer meaningful sleep improvements, but for now the scientific data on prescription sleeping pills suggests that they may not be the answer to returning sound sleep to those struggling to generate it on their own. Sleeping pills, the bad, and the ugly. Existing prescription sleeping pills are minimally helpful, but are they harmful, even deadly? Numerous studies have something to say on this point, yet much of the public remains unaware of their findings. Natural deep sleep, as we have previously learned, helps cement new memory traces within the brain, part of which require the active strengthening of connections between synapses that make up a memory circuit. How this essential nighttime storage function is affected by drug-induced sleep has been the focus of recent animal studies. After a period of intense learning, researchers at the University of Pennsylvania gave animals a weight-appropriate dose of Ambien or a placebo, and then examined the change in brain rewiring after sleep in both groups. As expected, natural sleep solidified memory connections within the brain in the placebo condition that had been formed during the initial learning phase. Ambien-induced sleep, however, not only failed to match these benefits, despite the animals sleeping just as long, but caused a 50% weakening, unwiring, of the brain cell connections originally formed during learning. In doing so, Ambien-laced sleep became a memory eraser rather than engraver. Should similar findings continue to emerge, including in humans, pharmaceutical companies may have to acknowledge that, although users of sleeping pills may fall asleep nominally faster at night, they should expect to wake up with fewer memories of yesterday. This is of special concern, considering the average age for those receiving sleep medication prescriptions is decreasing, as sleep complaints and incidents of pediatric insomnia increase, Should the former be true, doctors and parents may need to be vigilant about giving in to the temptation of prescriptions. Otherwise, young brains, which are still being wired up into the early 20s, will be attempting the already challenging task of neural development and learning under the subverting influence of prescription sleeping pills. Even more concerning than brain rewiring are medical effects throughout the body that come with the use of sleeping pills, effects that aren't widely known but should be. Most controversial and alarming are those highlighted by Dr. Daniel Kripke, a physician at the University of California, San Diego. Kripke discovered that individuals using prescription sleep medications are significantly more likely to die and to develop cancer than those who do not. I should note at the outset that Kripke, like me, has no vested interest in any particular drug company, and therefore does not stand to financially gain or lose on the basis of a particular examination of health relationships that exist with sleeping pills, good or bad. In the early 2000s, insomnia rates ballooned, and sleeping pill prescriptions escalated dramatically. It also meant much more data was available. Kripke began examining these large epidemiological databases. He wanted to explore whether there was a relationship between sleeping pill use and altered disease or mortality risk. There was. Time and again, the same message emerged from the analyses. Individuals taking sleeping pills were significantly more likely to die across the study periods, usually a handful of years, than those who were not, the reasons for which we will soon discuss. Often, however, it was tricky to conduct a well-matched comparison with these early databases, as there were not enough participants or measured factors that he could control for to really tease out a pure sleeping pill effect. But by 2012, however, there were. Kripke and his colleagues set up a well-controlled comparison, examining more than 10,000 patients taking sleeping pills, the vast majority of whom were taking Zolpidem, brand name Ambien, though some were taking Temazepam, brand name Restoril. He contrasted them with 20,000 very well-matched individuals of similar age, race, gender, and background, but who were not taking sleeping pills. In addition, Kripke was able to control for many other factors that could inadvertently contribute to mortality, such as body mass index, history of exercise, smoking, and drinking. He looked at the likelihood of disease and death across a 2.5-year window, shown in Figure 15 in the accompanying PDF. Those taking sleeping pills were 4.6 times more likely to die over this short 2.5-year period than those who were not using sleeping pills. Kripke further discovered that the risk of death scaled with the frequency of use. Those individuals classified as heavy users, defined as taking more than 132 pills per year, were 5.3 times more likely to die over the study period than matched control participants who were not using sleeping pills. More alarming was the mortality risk for people who only dabbled in sleeping pill use. Even very occasional users, those defined as taking just 18 pills per year, were still 3.6 times more likely to die at some point across the assessment window than non-users. Kripke isn't the only researcher finding such mortality risk associations. There are now more than 15 such studies from different groups around the world showing higher rates of mortality in those who use sleeping pills. What was killing those individuals using sleeping pills? That question is harder to answer from the available data, though it is clear that the sources are many. In an attempt to find answers, Kripke and other independent research groups have now evaluated data from studies involving almost all of the common sleeping pills, including Zolpidem, Ambien, Temazepam, Restoril, Esopiclone, Lunesta, Zaloplon, Sonata, and other sedating drugs such as Triazolam, Halcyon, and Flurazepam, Dalmane. One frequent cause of mortality appears to be higher than normal rates of infection. Also discussed in earlier chapters, natural sleep is one of the most powerful boosters of the immune system, helping ward off infection. Why then do individuals who are taking sleeping pills that purportedly improve sleep suffer higher rates of various infections when the opposite is predicted. It is possible that medication-induced sleep does not provide the same restorative immune benefits as natural sleep. This would be most troubling for the elderly. Older adults are far more likely to suffer from infections. Alongside newborns, they are the most immunologically vulnerable individuals in our society. Older adults are also the heaviest users of sleeping pills, representing more than 50% of the individuals prescribed such drugs. Based on these coincidental facts, it may be time for medicine to reappraise the prescription frequency of sleeping pills in the elderly. Another cause of death linked to sleeping pill use is an increased risk for fatal car accidents. This is most likely caused by the non-restorative sleep such drugs induce and or the groggy hangover that some suffer, both of which may leave individuals drowsy while driving the next day. Higher risk for falls at night was a further mortality factor, particularly in the elderly. Additional adverse associations in users of prescription sleeping pills included higher rates of heart disease and stroke. Then broke the story of cancer. Earlier studies had hinted at a relationship between the sleep medications and mortality risk from cancer, but were not as well controlled in terms of comparisons. Kripke's study did a far better job in this regard, and included the newer, more relevant sleeping medication, Ambien. Individuals taking sleeping pills were 30 to 40% more likely to develop cancer within the 2.5-year period of the study than those who were not. The older sleeping medications, such as temazepam, Restoril, had a stronger association, with those on mild to moderate doses suffering more than a 60% increased cancer risk. Those taking the highest dose of Zolpidem, Ambien, were still vulnerable, suffering almost a 30% greater likelihood of developing cancer across the 2.5-year study duration. Interestingly, animal experiments conducted by the drug companies themselves hint at the same carcinogenic danger. While the data from the drug companies submitted to the FDA website is somewhat obscure, it seems higher rates of cancer may have emerged in rats and mice dosed with these common sleeping pills. Do these findings prove that sleeping pills cause cancer? No, at least not by themselves. There are also alternative explanations. For example, it could be that the poor sleep that individuals were suffering prior to taking these drugs, that which motivated the prescription to begin with, and not the sleeping pill themselves, predisposed them to ill health. Moreover, the more problematic an individual's prior sleep, perhaps the more sleeping pills they later consumed, thus accounting for the dose-dependent mortality and dose-carcinogen relationships Kripke and others observed. But it is equally possible that sleeping pills do cause death and cancer. To obtain a definitive answer, we would need a dedicated clinical trial expressly designed to examine these particular morbidity and mortality risks. Ironically, such a trial may never be conducted, since a board of ethics may deem the already apparent death hazard and carcinogenic risks associated with sleeping pills to be too high. Shouldn't drug companies be more transparent about the current evidence and risks surrounding sleeping pill use? Unfortunately, Big Pharma can be notoriously unbending within the arena of revised medical indications. This is especially true once a drug has been approved following basic safety assessments, and even more so when profit margins become exorbitant. Consider that the original Star Wars movies, some of the highest-grossing films of all time, required more than 40 years to amass $3 billion in revenue. It took Ambien just 24 months to amass $4 billion in sales profit, discounting the black market. That's a large number, and one I can only imagine influences Big Pharma decision-making at all levels. Perhaps the most conservative and least litigious conclusion one can make about all of this evidence is that no study to date has shown that sleeping pills save lives. And, after all, isn't that the goal of medicine and drug treatments? In my scientific, though non-medical, opinion, I believe that the existing evidence warrants far more transparent medical education of any patient who is considering taking a sleeping pill, at the very least. This way, individuals can appreciate the risks and make informed choices. Do you, for example, feel differently about using or continuing to use sleeping pills, having learned about this evidence? To be very clear, I am not anti-medication. On the contrary, I desperately want there to be a drug that helps people obtain truly naturalistic sleep. Many of the drug company scientists who create sleeping medicines do so with nothing but good intent and an honest desire to help those for whom sleep is problematic. I know, because I have met many of them in my career. And as a researcher, I am keen to help science explore new medications in carefully controlled, independent studies. If such a drug, one with sound scientific data demonstrating benefits that far outweigh any health risks, is ultimately developed, I would support it. It is simply that no such medication currently exists. Don't take two of these. Instead, try these. While the search for more sophisticated sleep drugs continues, a new wave of exciting, non-pharmacological methods for improving sleep are fast emerging. Beyond the electrical, magnetic, and auditory stimulation methods for boosting deep sleep quality that I have previously discussed, and that are still in embryonic stages of development, there are already numerous and effective behavioral methods for improving your sleep, especially if you are suffering from insomnia. Currently, the most effective of these is called Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Insomnia, or CBTI, and it is rapidly being embraced by the medical community as the first-line treatment. Working with a therapist for several weeks, patients are provided with a bespoke set of techniques intended to break bad sleep habits and address anxieties that have been inhibiting sleep. CBTI builds on basic sleep hygiene principles that I describe in the appendix, supplemented with methods individualized for the patient, their problems, and their lifestyle. Some are obvious, others not so obvious, and still others are counterintuitive. The obvious methods involve reducing caffeine and alcohol intake, removing screen technology from the bedroom, and having a cool bedroom. In addition, patients must 1. Establish a regular bedtime and wake-up time, even on weekends. 2. Go to bed only when sleepy and avoid sleeping on the couch early mid-evenings. 3. Never lie awake in bed for a significant time period. Rather, get out of bed and do something quiet and relaxing until the urge to sleep returns. 4. Avoid daytime napping if you are having difficulty sleeping at night. 5. Reduce anxiety-provoking thoughts and worries by learning to mentally decelerate before bed. And 6. Remove visible clock faces from view in the bedroom, preventing clock-watching anxiety at night. One of the more paradoxical CBTI methods used to help insomniacs sleep is to restrict their time spent in bed, perhaps even to just 6 hours of sleep or less to begin with. By keeping patients awake for longer, we build up a strong sleep pressure, a greater abundance of adenosine. Under this heavier weight of sleep pressure, patients fall asleep faster and achieve a more stable, solid form of sleep across the night. In this way, a patient can regain their psychological confidence in being able to self-generate and sustain healthy, rapid, and sound sleep night after night, something that has eluded them for months, if not years. Upon re-establishing a patient's confidence in this regard, time in bed is gradually increased. While this may all sound a little contrived or even dubious, skeptical listeners, or those normally inclined toward drugs for help, should first evaluate the proven benefits of CBTI before dismissing it outright. Results, which have now been replicated in numerous clinical studies around the globe, demonstrate that CBTI is more effective than sleeping pills in addressing numerous problematic aspects of sleep for insomnia sufferers. CBTI consistently helps people fall asleep faster at night, sleep longer, and obtain superior sleep quality by significantly decreasing the amount of time spent awake at night. More importantly, the benefits of CBTI persist long-term, even after patients stop working with their sleep therapist. This sustainability stands in stark contrast to the punch of rebound insomnia that individuals experience following the cessation of sleeping pills. So powerful is the evidence favoring CBTI over sleeping pills for improved sleep across all levels, and so limited or non-existent are the safety risks associated with CBTI, unlike sleeping pills, that in 2016, the American College of Physicians made a landmark recommendation. A committee of distinguished sleep doctors and scientists evaluated all aspects of the efficacy and safety of CBTI relative to standard sleeping pills. Published in the prestigious journal Annals of Internal Medicine, the conclusion from this comprehensive evaluation of all existing data was this: CBTI must be used as the first-line treatment for all individuals with chronic insomnia, not sleeping pills. You can find more resources on CBTI and a list of qualified therapists from the National Sleep Foundation's website, sleepfoundation.org. If you have or think you have insomnia, please make use of these resources before turning to sleeping pills. General good sleep practices. For those of us who are not suffering from insomnia or another sleep disorder, there is much we can do to secure a far better night of sleep using what we call good sleep hygiene practices, for which a list of 12 key tips can be found at the National Institutes of Health website, also offered in the appendix of this book. All 12 suggestions are superb advice, but if you can only adhere to one of these each and every day, make it going to bed and waking up at the same time of day, no matter what. It is perhaps the single most effective way of helping improve your sleep, even though it involves the use of an alarm clock. Last but not least, two of the most frequent questions I receive from members of the public regarding sleep betterment concern exercise and diet. Sleep and physical exertion have a bidirectional relationship. Many of us know of the deep, sound sleep we often experience after sustained physical activity, such as a day-long hike, an extended bike ride, or even an exhausting day of working in the garden. Scientific studies dating back to the 1970s support some of this subjective wisdom, though perhaps not as strongly as you'd hope. One such early study, published in 1975, shows that progressively increased levels of physical activity in healthy males results in a corresponding progressive increase in the amount of deep NREM sleep they obtain on subsequent nights. In another study, however, active runners were compared with age and gender-matched non-runners. While runners had somewhat higher amounts of deep NREM sleep, it was not significantly different to the non-runners. Larger and more carefully controlled studies offer somewhat more positive news, but with an interesting wrinkle. In younger, healthy adults, exercise frequently increases total sleep time, especially deep NREM sleep. It also deepens the quality of sleep, resulting in more powerful electrical brainwave activity. Similar, if not larger, improvements in sleep time and efficiency are to be found in midlife and older adults, including those who are self-reported poor sleepers or those with clinically diagnosed insomnia. Typically, these studies involve measuring several nights of initial baseline sleep in individuals, after which they are placed on a regimen of exercise across several months. Researchers then examine whether or not there are corresponding improvements in sleep as a consequence. On average, there are. Subjective sleep quality improves, as does total amount of sleep. Moreover, the time it takes participants to fall asleep is usually less, and they report waking up fewer times across the night. In one of the longest manipulation studies to date, older adult insomniacs were sleeping almost 1 hour more each night, on average, by the end of a 4-month period of increased physical activity. Unexpected, however, was the lack of a tight relationship between exercise and subsequent sleep from one day to the next. That is, subjects did not consistently sleep better at night on the days they exercised compared with the days when they were not required to exercise, as one would expect. Less surprising, perhaps, is the inverse relationship between sleep and next-day exercise, rather than the influence of exercise on subsequent sleep at night. When sleep was poor the night prior, Exercise intensity and duration were far worse the following day. When sleep was sound, levels of physical exertion were powerfully maximal the next day. In other words, sleep may have more of an influence on exercise than exercise has on sleep. It is still a clear bidirectional relationship, however, with a significant trend toward increasingly better sleep with increasing levels of physical activity, and a strong influence of sleep on daytime physical activity. Participants also feel more alert and energetic as a result of the sleep improvement, and signs of depression proportionally decrease. It is clear that a sedentary life is one that does not help with sound sleep, and all of us should try to engage in some degree of regular exercise to help maintain not only the fitness of our bodies, but also the quantity and quality of our sleep. Sleep, in return, will boost your fitness and energy, setting in motion a positive, self-sustaining cycle of improved physical activity and mental health. One brief note of caution regarding physical activity: try not to exercise right before bed. Body temperature can remain high for an hour or two after physical exertion. Should this occur too close to bedtime, it can be difficult to drop your core temperature sufficiently to initiate sleep due to the exercise-driven increase in metabolic rate. Best to get your workout in at least 2 to 3 hours before turning the bedside light out. Non-LED powered, I trust. When it comes to diet, there is limited research investigating how the foods you eat and the pattern of eating impact your sleep at night. Severe caloric restriction, such as reducing food intake to just 800 calories a day for 1 month, makes it harder to fall asleep normally and decreases the amount of deep NREM sleep at night. What you eat also appears to have some impact on your nighttime sleep. Eating a high carbohydrate, low-fat diet for 2 days decreases the amount of deep NREM sleep at night, but increases the amount of REM sleep dreaming relative to a 2-day diet low in carbohydrates and high in fat. In a carefully controlled study of healthy adult individuals, a 4-day diet high in sugar and other carbohydrates, but low in fiber, resulted in less deep NREM sleep and more awakenings at night. It is hard to make definitive recommendations for the average adult, especially because larger-scale epidemiological studies have not shown consistent associations between eating specific food groups and sleep quantity or quality. Nevertheless, for healthy sleep, the scientific evidence suggests that you should avoid going to bed too full or too hungry, and shy away from diets that are excessively biased toward carbohydrates, greater than 70% of all energy intake, especially sugar. Chapter 15. Sleep and Society. What medicine and education are doing wrong, what Google and NASA are doing right. 100 years ago, less than 2% of the population in the United States slept 6 hours or less a night. Now, almost 30% of American adults do. The lens of a 2013 survey by the National Sleep Foundation pulls this sleep deficiency into sharp focus. More than 65% of the U.S. adult population failed to obtain the recommended 7 to 9 hours of sleep each night during the week. Circumnavigate the globe, and things look no better. In the UK and Japan, for example, 39 and 66% respectively of all adults report sleeping fewer than 7 hours. Deep currents of sleep neglect circulate throughout all developed nations, and it is for these reasons that the World Health Organization now labels the lack of societal sleep as a global health epidemic. Taken as a whole, 1 out of every 2 adults across all developed countries, approximately 800 million people, will not get the necessary sleep they need this coming week. Importantly, many of these individuals do not report wanting or needing less sleep. If you look at sleep time in first world nations for the weekends, the numbers are very different. Rather than a meager 30% of adults getting 8 hours of sleep or more on average, almost 60% of these individuals attempt to binge on 8 or more hours. Each weekend, Vast numbers of people are desperately trying to pay back a sleep debt they've accrued during the week. As we have learned time and again throughout the course of this book, sleep is not like a credit system or the bank. The brain can never recover all the sleep it has been deprived of. We cannot accumulate a debt without penalty, nor can we repay that sleep debt at a later time. Beyond any single individual, why should society care? Would altering sleep attitudes and increasing sleep amounts make any difference to our collective lives as a human race, to our professions and corporations, to commercial productivity, to salaries, the education of our children, or even our moral nature? Whether you are a business leader or employee, the director of a hospital, a practicing doctor or nurse, a government official or military person, a public policymaker or community health worker, anyone who expects to receive any form of medical care at any moment in their life, or a parent, the answer is very much yes, for more reasons than you may imagine. In the following, I offer four diverse yet clear examples how insufficient sleep is impacting the fabric of human society. These are sleep in the workplace, torture, yes, torture, sleep in the education system, and sleep in medicine and healthcare. Sleep in the workplace. Sleep deprivation degrades many of the key faculties required for most forms of employment. Why then do we overvalue employees that undervalue sleep? We glorify the high-powered executive on email until 1 a.m., and then in the office by 5:45 a.m. We laud the airport warrior, who has traveled through 5 different time zones on 7 flights over the past 8 days. There remains a contrived, yet fortified, arrogance in many business cultures, focused on the uselessness of sleep. It is bizarre considering how sensible the professional world is regarding all other areas of employee health, safety and conduct. As my Harvard colleague, Dr. Seisler, has pointed out, innumerable policies exist within the workplace regarding smoking, substance abuse, ethical behavior, and injury and disease prevention. But insufficient sleep, another harmful, potentially deadly factor, is commonly tolerated and even woefully encouraged. This mentality has persisted, in part, because certain business leaders mistakenly believe that time on task equates with task completion and productivity. Even in the industrial era of rote factory work, this was untrue. It is a misguided fallacy, and an expensive one too. A study across 4 large U.S. companies found that insufficient sleep cost almost $2,000 per employee per year in lost productivity. That amount rose to over $3,500 per employee in those suffering the most serious lack of sleep. That may sound trivial, but speak to the bean counters that monitor such things, and you discover a net capital loss to these companies of $54 million annually. Ask any board of directors whether they would like to correct a single problem fleecing their company of more than $50 million a year in lost revenue, and the vote will be rapid and unanimous. An independent report by the Rand Corporation on the economic cost of insufficient sleep offers a sobering wake-up call for CFOs and CEOs. Individuals who sleep fewer than 7 hours a night on average cause a staggering fiscal cost to their country, compared to employees who sleep more than 8 hours each night. Shown in Figure 16A in the accompanying PDF, inadequate sleep costs America and Japan $411 billion and $138 billion each year, respectively. The UK, Canada, and Germany follow. Of course, these numbers are skewed by the size of the country. A standardized way to appreciate the impact is by looking at gross domestic product, GDP, a general measure of a country's profit output or economic health. Viewed this way, things look even more bleak, described in Figure 16B in the accompanying PDF. Insufficient sleep robs most nations of more than 2% of their GDP, amounting to the entire cost of each country's military. It's almost as much as each country invests in education. Just think, If we eliminated the national sleep debt, we could almost double the GDP percentage that is devoted to the education of our children. One more way that abundant sleep makes financial sense and should itself be incentivized at the national level. Why are individuals so financially ruinous to their companies and national economies when they are under